Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Miamisburg, Ohio. He was a 5'11", 187-pound wide receiver with average speed and was drafted by the Houston Oilers in 1976. He was released in training camp and signed by the Seattle Seahawks. He played 14 years and was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He then served in the U.S. House of Representatives for Oklahoma from 1994 until 2002. Today he's the president and CEO of CETA. His name, Steve Largent. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Steve Largent, the president and CEO of CETA. Steve, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Okay. Well, I had a little bit of an unusual childhood in that my parents were divorced in about 1960 or 61. I was 6 years old in first grade, and I saw my dad take off standing in the driveway, and I saw him leave. And it was a really difficult time. I had two younger brothers, and seeing your dad take off when you're 6 years old, you really don't know exactly how to put all those pieces together. And unfortunately, my mother and father had a they did not have a good relationship, and it got worse after the divorce. In that my father, my mom always pursued my father in, to pay his child support payments and that sort of thing, and my dad tried to avoid paying child support, and so it just was a nasty situation. It really was.
What did you learn from your mom?
Well, my mom is very resilient. She is. She was an incredibly hard worker. I mean, you can't imagine how hard it was on her to raise three small kids back in 1960, 61, 62. When she was doing that. So, you know, I gained a tremendous amount of respect for my mom over the years, watching how hard that she was willing to work and try to keep some semblance of a family life going for her three sons.
How did you get through not having a dad?
Well, when my parents were divorced, my mom moved back from Tulsa to Oklahoma City, and that's where her parents, my grandparents, lived. And my grandfather really came to play a significant role in my life, kind of a surrogate father role. And so he coached my little league baseball teams and came to a lot of the events and that sort of thing, and played a very significant role in my life.
You're a sophomore in high school. You try out for the football team. You're one of 150 kids trying out, and you quit. Why?
Well, I thought about it. I actually went out for the team the first day, and there were so many young guys there trying out for this team, and they were all bigger and stronger and hairier than I was. And so I went back home, and I told my mom that I thought I was going to quit. And she, thank goodness, the better head and thought prevailed, because she really convinced me that you know, that I was a good football player and that I would be sorry if I quit, and you know, I should go out there and compete and just do the best that I could. And she kind of gave me the typical parent story, and I bought it hook, line, and sinker. And lo and behold, she was right, and it turned out to be a very pivotal decision in my life.
For young people today, Steve, peer pressure is phenomenal, and the fear of failing is paralyzing. What would you say to young people about those two issues?
Well, you know, we look at that today, and you know, now I'm looking at, I'm 52 years old, and I've been out of high school since I was 18, and that's a long time, we forget that fear of failure. We think today that we can just say to a young person that, you know, just go give it your best, and who cares if you fail, but you should go and try it. That's easy for us to say when we're 50 years old. It's a lot harder when you're 15, 16, 17, 18 years old and you're in high school, and that fear of failure is so paralyzing. The admiration, respect of your peers is so empowering, and you don't want to do anything to jeopardize that sort of acceptance that you get. And when you're going out and you're competing, and you're competing with another school, another person, to be a member of a team or whatever, it can be a very, very intimidating experience. So I think we can't take that decision lightly. It's a critical decision for young people, but I think it's a critically important decision that we try to shepherd them through this process and help them to see both the challenges the results of failing and what you can learn from that. I think that we talk a lot about the joys of victory. But in reality, so many young people fail, and we miss the opportunity to teach our young people the lessons that you learn, the valuable lessons that you learn when you fail. Because the truth be known, we all fail at something somewhere along the road. I think for parents in particular, it's important to put yourself in a position to teach your kids not only the exhilaration of winning and what you can learn from being victorious, but also what you learn from losing. And losing is not something that Americans in particular like to talk a lot about. But the fact is, we all lose from time to time. And the important aspect, or the important quality, is how do you pick yourself up? How do you deal with this setback and move forward as a result?
We're talking to Steve Largent, who had a tremendous football career with Tulsa University. When we come back, we'll ask him what happened after he graduated. This is Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Steve Largent. Steve, you graduate from Tulsa University. You get selected in the fourth round in the 76 draft by the Houston Oilers. Can you talk about what happened?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that, but I would tell you maybe the most significant event, one of the most significant events that occurred in my life actually occurred while I was a student at the University of Tulsa, and that's when I married my wife, now of 32 years, Terry Largent, and we were married our junior year in college, and I would tell you that she has been just the best friend, best counselor, best wife a guy could ever ask for, and a great mom, and now a great grandmother. So she is, she definitely is the star of my life. And that occurred when we were juniors in college. But I graduated from the University of Tulsa, and in reality, I had worked very hard to get a degree, and I got my degree in biology, and I'd worked very hard to get that degree because professional football was even beyond my realm of imagination to be able to have the opportunity to play in the National Football League was something I never even thought about. So I got my degree and was ready to pursue whatever I was going to do life after college. I got drafted by the Houston Oilers in the fourth round. Bum Phillips was the head coach at that time. Our head coach, F.A. Dry, at the University of Tulsa, had some friends at with the Oilers, and he had spoken very highly of me. And so they took a chance on me, and they drafted me in the fourth round. And I went down there and spent 6 weeks trying to figure out what I was doing and in training camp. And at the end of the sixth week, Bum Phillips came to me. He said, Steve, he said, we have some guys on our team that I know are not going to make the team. But I'm going to release you now so you have an opportunity to play with somebody else, give you a chance to go and try to catch on with another team. And, of course, I didn't believe him when he told me that. I thought it was just the easier way to let a guy go that you were going to release from your team. But that was the truth. And so Bum Phillips released me after 6 weeks in training camp, and I was the most dejected guy you can ever imagine. I cried as I drove all of my stuff back from Houston back to Oklahoma to figure out my life's work path. But I cried the whole way back. And when I got back to Oklahoma City, where my folks were and my wife was, I got a call from Seattle. And they said, we want to give you a second chance, and can you get up here? And so I said, sure. And I packed all the clothes that I took up to Seattle. I had in one small sack, and I took that with me, and I went up there, and I worked very hard. And I actually had a coach from the University of Tulsa that had signed on with the Seahawks in the first year that they existed as a franchise. And he, more than anybody else, really helped me in developing my game and my attitude to get through their training camp and preseason and make the team.
What did being cut teach you?
You know, I think that resiliency is the word that comes to my mind right away. And the truth is, it wasn't the first time that I had experienced that sort of rejection is the way it felt in my life. But I think I really learned that in life you have to be resilient. You have to be able to know how to bounce back and keep going. That there's going to be a series of things that happen in your life that are not going to be viewed favorably, that you're going to view as rejections or failures. And you've got to learn to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep moving forward.
You spent 14 years with the Seahawks. When you retired, you had the most receptions in a career, most receiving yards in a career, most touchdown receptions. You were arguably the greatest receiver of all time in the NFL. Can you talk about your career and how you did that being this little, tiny, slow receiver?
Well, you can't be a good player, much less a great player in the league, without having a lot of help. And I had great coaching. Jerry Rome was that coach from the University of Tulsa who really brought me under his wing initially and taught me a lot about life and a lot about football. I had some other great coaches along the way that obviously crafted a game plan that suited my abilities. And then it goes without saying that I had great quarterbacks to get me the ball. And I mean, football, the bottom line is football is not an individual sport. I know that, you know, you watch ESPN or anybody else today and they try to fashion it that way. Basketball is not an individual sport and football isn't either. And so, you know, you're only as good as those guys around you. But I had a lot of great guys that were around me, particularly in my playing career. I had two really good quarterbacks, and Dave Craig at the end of my career and Jim Zorn at the beginning of my career. Both guys are guys that really knew how to work hard, enjoyed working hard. I enjoyed working hard, and we developed the kind of rapport that you have to have on a football field when the heat's on, the pressure's on, and the other team's at your throat. And you have to perform. So I guess I was just very, very fortunate to end up in a system with coaches and teammates that were willing to utilize the abilities that I had and not expect me to do things that I couldn't do.
All those records that you held, They've all been broken.
Mm-hmm.
Was that tough to watch them be broken?
You know, it really wasn't at all. They were never a goal or aspiration that I had to set records. I never even believed that I could play in the National Football League, much less hold any records. And so I always held those with an open hand, knowing that there would definitely be somebody that would come along after I did and surpass me. And that's okay.
You say that football is a team sport, Steve. What does team mean to you?
I think it's a willingness to deny your own sometimes selfish desires for the good of the team. Being willing to sacrifice, you know, how many catches you could make or yards you could gain in order to win the game as a team. And we had a coach in Seattle, Chuck Knox, who a great, great football coach and a better person, who always used to talk about that, you know, when you win, all the other stuff comes with it. So all the stuff that you're seeking as an individual, as a player, if you can win as a team, you'll get that stuff on the side. So his point was, if you can learn to deny your own selfish ambitions and sacrifice in your performance as a team player, that at the end of the day, you'll get all the gratification that you ever wanted as an individual. And I think that that's really true. I think that if you can learn as a player in a team sport to put your own selfish ambitions behind you and really seek the good of the team, that you'll find at the end of the day that is the greatest gratification. And I think you ask a guy that plays for the Indianapolis Colts today who just won the Super Bowl, that they would say, absolutely, that's true. I didn't make the Pro Bowl, but we won the Super Bowl. That's a trade that any player would make at any time.
We're talking to Steve Largent, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything is Possible with Jack Crisula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Steve Largent, who was named the NFL Man of the Year in 1988. Steve, could you share with us the famous fumble recovery against the Broncos?
We were playing Denver. It was a game we were playing in Denver. We played them twice a year, once at our place and once at their place. We were in the same division in the AFC West. And we had fallen behind the first half. We came out the second half. We threw a little like a screen pass to Kurt Warner, who was our star running back. And he took the ball and started making his way up the field. And he got about 17, 18 yards up the field, and he got hit by half the Denver Bronco defense. And when he was hit, I was down there trying to block for him, getting somebody's way. And when he was hit, I saw the ball come out. It came loose, and you know, of course, being the alert wide receiver that I was, I immediately pounced on it. And a really funny thing happened: nothing. Usually, when you jump on a fumble in the NFL, you're immediately there's a big dog pile, and you just try to hold on to the ball with all you've got. So the fact that didn't happen was a little puzzling. But I jumped up and held the ball over my head, and indicated that we had recovered the ball and Seahawks ball first down. And when I came up, I was looking eyeball to eyeball to one of the officials, and I said, and he was signaling first down Denver Broncos. And of course, I was the team captain at that time, and I told him I had to disagree with him because I had the ball in my hand. And he put his arm around me, which I knew that there was something wrong as soon as he did that. And he said, "Steve, I'm sorry, but that ball that you recovered was not the one that Kurt fumbled. But it was a young man on the sideline whose responsibility it is to exchange balls with the official in between every play. He got excited, saw Kurt run down the field. As he ran down the field to follow the play, he tripped on the yard marker and fumbled his ball out on the field, and that's the one that you've recovered." So, of course, I was immensely embarrassed and put my helmet on, went and stood under the bench for the rest of the game. But that was maybe the answer to the question, what was your most embarrassing moment playing in the National Football League? That was the answer.
We're talking to Steve Largent. When we come back, we'll talk to him about running and becoming a U.S. congressman. This is Jack Krasula, and Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Steve Largent, who was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1997. Steve, it's 1994, and you decide to run for the U.S. Congress. Why?
You know, that's a good question. I'd retired in 1989, really 1990, and moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is my hometown, and was working there in Tulsa. And my wife was actually the one whose idea it was to at least pursue something in the way of helping our community and helping others. And I got a call from Don Nichols, who was our U.S. Senator at that time, and he said that there was an opportunity to run for Congress because our congressman was stepping out of his seat, and he wanted to know if I was interested. And, of course, I said, absolutely not. When I retired from the NFL, I got asked that question all the time, what are you going to do now? And I said, there's two things I'm not going to do, but that leaves a lot open. I said, I'm not going to coach in the National Football League, and I'm not going to run for politics. So this was one of the two things that I said I would never do. But when Don called and I told my wife, she said, you know, I think you really need to think and pray about that. And so we spent about a week or two thinking and praying about that. And at the end of the day, all I can tell you is that my mind was changed, and I knew that that was what I was supposed to do, even if I wasn't going to win, because I got in a six-way primary. So, and you have to get 50% plus one vote to avoid a runoff. And in that July election, in 1994, I got 51% and went into the general election, got 63% of the vote, and now I was in Congress, and I couldn't have told you the difference between the White House and Congress in terms of the buildings, because I was doing an interview in front of Congress, and I kept referring to it as the White House. So, I mean, I never had any aspirations to run for political office, but I did want to run to serve the public and to try to vote and serve their interests in Washington, D.C. And I would tell you today it was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life.
What did being in Congress for 8 years teach you?
Gosh, there's a whole list of things that I learned from being in the United States Congress. I learned what it meant to be committed. I learned what it meant to be dedicated. You know, I saw the many, many examples, both from our forefathers, our founding fathers, the documents that they left for us, the Declaration of Independence, and all the founding documents. And I just saw story after story of people whose lives were built on sacrifice and sacrifice for others. And it was a very compelling story for me, one that I had read from a distance in seventh grade and eighth grade and ninth grade, but never really sensed as palpably as I did when I served in Congress. And then I saw not only the stories of our forefathers and how they served and sacrificed, but I saw real life examples in front of me, serving in the Senate and the House and in the White House. People who were sacrificing for the good of our country. And I saw people in the military sacrificing, sometimes even their very lives, for the good of our country. And it was like a slap in the face for me to realize how much we have to be grateful for in this great country, and that we didn't gain this because we were smarter or that we had more money or that we had more resources than the other guy. We gained all these tremendous benefits because of the sacrifice of many.
The animosity in Washington, D.C., what's the solution?
Well, I'd be one of those guys that would say the animosity is probably something that's overplayed in the media. I see a lot of Republicans and Democrats that get along very well. I meet with a group of guys every Tuesday night, Republicans and Democrats, who I would say love each other and genuinely do. Now they don't. They have disagreements over policy debates, but they genuinely love one another. So I think to some degree that's overstated or overplayed in the general media. But I think too that the differences of opinion that you have in Congress are a healthy thing. That we don't want to send a bunch of people that agree with each other on everything. You don't want to have a marriage like that. I think most people that are married know that there are differences of opinion that they have with their own wife or their own husband, and that if they can learn to deal with those and to do it in a constructive way, they actually find they have a stronger marriage. And I learned in Congress that if you can learn to deal constructively with differences of opinion, that you can actually end up with a stronger Congress and stronger country as a result.
What advice would you give to a listener tonight who's thinking of running for public service?
You know, I think it's a great calling, and it has to be a calling. I don't think anybody does this for the money or does it for any other reason. But you have to know that it does call upon people that want to serve. It calls upon them to make some sacrifices, and they have to be willing to do that. But I would say to anybody that wants to serve that it is a tremendous sacrifice, but it's also a tremendous privilege when you have the opportunity to serve.
It's 2002, and you decide to run for governor of Oklahoma. Can you share that experience?
Yeah, it was actually, I had served 8 years in Congress. I had decided to leave Congress. I actually ended up leaving about 8 months early to run for governor. I didn't feel like it was right to hold one seat while you were running for another seat. And so I left my seat in Congress, and I sought to pursue the governorship of Oklahoma. I felt like that it was time for me to come home. I had served my country and served my time in Congress, and that perhaps that I was supposed to run for governor. And I think I was. I wasn't successful. I lost by 6,500 votes at the end of the day. But I would tell you still, even though I lost the election, that was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life, is running for governor in the state of Oklahoma. I met so many wonderful people all across the state. I learned a lot of issues that we have in Oklahoma, and I learned a lot about myself. So it could not have been a better experience. Even though I lost, it was a great experience.
How did you get over that very public loss?
I would like to tell you it was really easy to get over it, but it was not. It probably took 2 or 3 years before the sting of losing went away. So it's just been the last couple of years that I can say honestly that I don't think about it anymore, because there was about a 2 year period that every morning I woke up, I thought about that election and the fact that I lost. And it wasn't from, losing it on a personal basis. It didn't have anything to do with that. It was just trying to figure out some answers about, why the Lord would have me run for office and then lose. When everybody thought I was going to win. And I still don't know that I have a definitive answer on that. But I've come to a sense to have a sense of peace about the decision and the result. That's it.
We're talking to Steve Largent, and I'm Jack Grisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Steve Largent. Steve, you and your wife, Terry, are blessed with 4 children. Your youngest, Kramer, has spina bifida. Could you talk to us about that?
Well, that was probably one of the most devastating things that's happened to me. Is to learn that your son has been born with a debilitating birth defect, spina bifida, Kramer was born in 1985. We were in the middle of the Seahawks season, and we had no idea that that he had any sort of disability at all. My wife had actually taken a test to ensure that that our child was healthy and whole, and the test came back negative, that there was not a problem. And that was the first time she'd ever been tested, because they had just developed this one test, and so she was tested and it came back negatively. So we had no expectations at all that our child would be born with a birth defect. But when he was, it really was a difficult time for our family, obviously, to go through that. So I can remember bringing Kramer home, and our three younger kids had all, painted pictures and drawn signs for welcoming Kramer back to the house and that sort of thing. And here we come bringing him back, and he has to stay laid face down because he's got this surgery that he had on his back within 24 hours of being born, and to close the opening in his back. And, already his head has begun to swell because of the amniotic fluid the spinal fluid that's backing up in his head. And he ended up having to have a shunt put into his head after about a year to get rid of that excess pressure. So there was just a lot of physical abnormalities about Kramer, not necessarily the way he looked or anything like that, but just things that we had to deal with that we never had to deal with before with our other three kids. And I think my wife and I would both say that as far as we're concerned, we could say honestly that we're glad that we have Kramer, because we have learned so much in and through him that it has affected our lives in a positive way. It's been hard, but it's affected our lives in a positive way more than anything else. Now, for Kramer, we definitely wish that he didn't have spina bifida. Because it's really impacted his ability to do a lot of things that our other kids have been able to do. But for my wife and I, we would both say that we have learned so much by going through that process. It's been hard, no question about that, but it has been a growth experience for both of us.
It's been amazing to me how many times I've heard families with a special needs child refer to that child as their hero, their angel, their gift from God, their teacher. Why is that, Steve?
I think we have learned a lot through Kramer's experiences, but the thing about Kramer is that we have tried to bring him up as normally as possible. We've not tried to treat him any differently than our other kids, and he's responded very, very well to that. And I would not say Kramer is an angel. I wouldn't say that he's our perfect child or anything like that. He's just like our other three children. And that's the kind of experience that we wanted to give him as our child, is a normal, healthy, whole experience, but not one that's fabricated or plastic in any sort of way. And he's responded to that. And he is a great kid. And I think that... He definitely holds a special place in our hearts, but he is really matured to become a very special guy.
This is a long question. Doug Flutie, Heisman quarterback, special needs son. Dan Marino holds arguably every passing record in the NFL, special needs son. Jim Kelly took the Bills to four Super Bowls, special needs son. Boomer Esiason, greatest Bengal quarterback ever, special needs son, and you and Terry. How do you explain that?
You mean how come I'm not a quarterback?
Why in God's master plan do you think this happens?
I really don't know. I wish I had a definitive answer for you, but I think that the thing I'm proud to say is that I've seen each one of those guys that you've mentioned in public forums, very public forums, in fact, doing commercials and stuff, to bring attention to kids that have been subjected to the same type of birth defects that their children have had. And, you know, I think that as a professional athlete, when you see that you have the ability to play that kind of a role in society, to bring attention to a particular malady or some sort of a problem or issue, and you can bring attention to it and help raise money to alleviate the problem for people that are experiencing the same sorts of things that you've experienced, it just makes you feel good that you know, you can utilize the platform that you've been given, and I think it's God-given, and use that in a constructive way to help others. You know, I don't think it gets any better than that.
Can you share with us what you're doing today?
Well, yeah, I'm the head of the trade association that represents all the companies that are in the wireless business, the cellular business. So we represent all the carriers from Singular and Sprint, Nextel, and Verizon, and T-Mobile, and Altel, and all the carriers, as well as all the handset manufacturers. So Motorola, Samsung, Nokia, all those guys. And we advocate for them here in Washington, D.C. We host two trade shows a year for this association, and we get involved in issues that the carriers can't do themselves because of antitrust rules. We're the trusted third party that gets in the middle and helps organize things like being able to text message from a Sprint Nextel phone to a Verizon phone and make sure that those systems work. And it is a great business, a great job, because I'm front and center on all the latest technology, and I get to watch this tremendous growth take place in this country.
Is there any limits to what these phones are going to be able to do in the future?
I don't think so. I haven't seen any limitations yet. It's very exciting. You know, our service is not where we want it to be, but it's certainly a lot better than it was even just 3 or 4 years ago. But it's getting better and better. You can do more and more things with your phone. And I think you're going to see a day where you don't have to carry credit cards anymore, because you'll have your cell phone that can do those kinds of credits and debits at your bank account in stores. So I think the list of things, including public safety type issues, where, you know, you can help locate missing children or distress calls, or actually use your phone to monitor heart rates, or, you know, when you have a heart attack to make emergency calls. Those types of things are either already happening within our industry or about to come onto the industry.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
That's a great question. You know, I think that my advice would be, number one, to be true to yourself. Understand who you are and what you're about. I think maybe the most important thing that I have learned in my life is that it's important that you that you're a servant, that you need to serve others, that's really our purpose in life, is to serve others and not to be served. And I think you can learn so many lessons through that experience that really can make you into the man or woman that God intends us to be.
Wow, what a role model. You are a living servant.
Well, thank you, Jack.
Thanks for coming on. Our guest next Sunday will be the former chairman and president of Chrysler, the man who hired Lee Iacocca, and the two of them went and obtained the bailout from Jimmy Carter. His name, John Ricardo. Until then, I'm Jack Crisula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoiler.